have a chance to do this and things start to roll. I really want to thank all you guys for joining in. I think it's really the spirit of foamed and this unprecedented crisis that although it's putting everyone apart, it's also putting one, putting people together in different ways. So really thanks a lot for putting this together and sharing your experiences. Make sure Laura gets on. Alrighty, so I think we can start rolling. So welcome to our COVID-19 respiratory management with a physiological approach. And we're here to share experiences, knowledge, thoughts, all in the hopes of helping to treat our many, many, many critically ill and acutely ill COVID patients. So I'm gonna start with asking Marco to introduce himself and to start telling us about his experience and the knowledge he's gained in Italy.
Well, hello, everybody. I'm Marco Garrone. I'm an emergency physician from Italy. I work in Torino, the Hospital Mauriziano. Well, the knowledge we've gained it from a lot of mistakes we made, actually. Because we were hit as a second nation just after China. And I guess we were a bit slow in recognizing the key features, key patterns of this disease. We started actually with what was the intubate more or less as fast as you can, these patients. So a sort of preemptive intubation after a very small CPAP or an IV challenge. And looking back, we now recognize that this strategy does not work. It doesn't work for the single patient because most often these patients don't fare well once intubated. Endotracheal intubation does not prevent these people from deteriorating. And secondly, because it wasn't feasible counting the number of patients we had. So we started off intubating far too many patients. And this is the most important lesson we learned it, and we learned it the hard way, obviously. So we gradually shifted from very small CPAP or NIV challenges to trials. We shifted off to a more prolonged non-invasive strategy. And I must say that this has paid off really well because with the percentage of patients that have been intubated has been gradually reducing. And I guess that we have a much better selection now of the patient who really needs invasive support. This is it. This is the main part of it.
Now, nowadays that you're not intubating, what are you going with as first line, second line? How do you decide what you progress to the next type of ventilation?
Well, we usually start off with CPAP and we try to keep them on CPAP as much as possible. We usually don't put them on an NIV unless they have a history of COPD or signs of initial work, excessive muscle fatigue, or if they develop let's say they are normal capnic. Because these patients are usually both deeply hypoxic and hypocapnic. This is our strategy so far. And we've got people who are now, after 2 weeks of CPAP, weaned and healthy and discharged. So I guess this is the key point.
So that's essentially the proof in concept, because those patients a month ago you would have intubated.
Yeah, most of them I would have done it.
So there's your, you know, certainly the proof of the concept that you can get away with just the CPAP on the patients that you'd normally would have intubated, but now essentially avoided, you know, ventilation altogether, which I think is the main question on many people's minds when attempting these things. Is it, am I just delaying, or am I actually going to get away with it and avoid the complications of ventilation?
Yeah, I agree. I think this, we started with a, let's say, one size fits all attitude that didn't pay off. We tried to delay intubation as much as possible. Obviously, we have a sort of red alerts concerning history of the patient. Let's say diabetic, overweight, previous coronary disease. These patients are obviously monitored particularly carefully, obviously, because these are the most likely to need a invasive support. But we usually tend to delay intubation, yes.
Okay.
Also, because even the people who have been intubated early have stayed on the on a mechanical ventilator for more than 2 weeks on average. The average stay in my ICU is about 14 days. Mm-hmm. And even for the early intubation strategy patients.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Marco. And actually, it brings to Cameron, we talked about a week or so ago, and certainly your discussions went viral essentially, and you brought up a lot of those points in a very explosive way, and I think, you know, really brought the attention to this. Can you tell us about your experience?
Yeah, so thank you for having me. My name is Cameron Casadell. I work at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn. So right now in New York, we are sort of in the midst of it where, you know, we can't tell if the peak was yesterday or the peak's tomorrow or the peak's, you know, 2 weeks from now. So we're really, you know, we're slugging through it now. Initially, I was working in the ICU. And because, trying to learn from people who've experienced this before, specifically in Italy and China, and we're, you know, hearing the high mortality rates on vents, we did try to do what we could to try to avoid that. And the initial thought was just to, if we can shave off a couple of days in the beginning, that we might be able to lessen, the length of the vent run. And so we started using high flow. We had access to it, and so we started using it, and we were able to take people far. And from my own observation, we were just seeing mine and my colleagues and the residents I work with, we're just seeing things that we had never seen before. And the clinical syndrome in front of me was perplexing. And I think that in some ways, one must reach that perplexed state of confusion when you stare at someone who is significantly hypoxemic. And by that, I mean, on high flow at a, 90%, 50 liters a minute, within probably an alveolar FiO2 somewhere in, the mid 90s or maybe low 90s, and still saturating 80%. So, a major A gradient and comfortable, looking at you comfortable and saying they're not short of breath. And it was that sort of perplexed state of confusion when we were trying to discuss whether they needed a breathing tube in the face of such a high mortality that, made me feel that this was a syndrome I have never seen. And, what I have witnessed, which is different than what I witnessed in seeing pulmonary conditions, specifically in a respiratory failure and fellowship, is that what this appeared to me to be, what it does appear to me to be, is a progressive oxygen failure, which in my mind is something different than respiratory failure. And I don't see many patients on the verge of what we say tiring out. I see patients with progressively lower PaO2s, despite the increasing amounts of supplemental O2 that we're giving them. Now I'm in the ER, and our ER is full of critical care patients. We have a lot of patients on the floor waiting for critical care beds. So we are creating a team to try to take care, sort of an ICU team within the ER to try to take care of all of the ICU patients. And one of the crazy things I've noticed about this disease is it turns your hospital upside down. And by that, I mean, our hospitals used to having, 500, 600, 700 people with maybe 200 diseases that were very good at treating, it's a very good hospital and we're able to treat our usual cardiac GI conditions, very well. But now we are struggling with several hundred people to treat a disease that we don't quite understand. And it really flips things inside out. For example, there really is no place in the hospital for an unmonitored COVID patient, meaning that we're not sending people home because they look good. We're essentially admitting everyone that looks not so good. So people aren't admitted to the hospital if they look great. And those patients that are admitted to the hospital certainly follow a path of progressive hypoxemia. So they might look good today and tomorrow they can be hypoxemic. And the next day, they could be significantly hypoxemic. And yet most of our hospital beds, as most hospitals, are not monitored. So if you could do whatever you wanted, it's almost as if you would admit him from the ER to a bed upstairs. And then in a day later, they got worse. You'd bring them back to the ER, which, everyone knows is an impossibility with the system in which we work. So right now we are holding all of our high flow patients in the ER. So we were able to secure a tremendous amount of high flow machines. And, unfortunately there's nowhere they can go. Our ICU are filled with intubated patients and a high flow patient cannot go to the floor because they become fully dependent on that oxygen. And were that oxygen to fall off, for many of them within minutes, they would die. So, how we're starting to treat it, and we can, when we talk about later, as far as ventilatory strategies, how I envision it is an oxygen first strategy, which is to say that everything that we are doing, other than the, therapies to try to decrease viral replication and to actually attack the disease, is simply to try to get the alveolar FiO2 as high as possible. So that is what we are struggling with now. Is at what point do you decide, especially with high flow patients who can talk to you and who feel well to a certain point, when do you decide to intubate them? And it's, every day today, me and, two, three other ER doctors were perplexed with multiple patients. And, we all, I almost joke that it's a hard decision. It really is. It's one of the most, difficult decisions as an emergency physician I have ever had with these patients. Furthermore, you get to know them over a couple of days, So by the time you're, talking about intubating them, you may know them fairly well. So, I kind of joked, but not really, that really this should be a decision made between two attendings so that neither of you feels fully responsible. So that's sort of the setup of what our ER looks like now, and sort of the struggles that we're going through and sort of the model in which we are approaching ventilation.
Thanks. I'm going to jump in with just a nuts and bolts question about the high flow, since you've been using it a lot. The way we've been using it is to go with as near 100% as we can and a low flow rate in order to minimize that theoretical aerosolization risk. Is that something you've been doing?
So, initially I was titrating the FiO2, and now we're kind of, we switched it where we're leaving it at 100% and we are titrating the flow. We have somewhat, I think, accepted. I mean, many patients are on 50 and some are even 60 liters. So we somewhat have accepted the risk. And it is just something that now we kind of deal with. One thing I will say, just to remind people about high flow, is it uses a tremendous amount of oxygen. And so certainly if your hospital is going to embrace it, you got to make sure you secure your oxygen supply. It's uses a lot more than a vent. It's sort of put it in context. If you have 60 liters at 100%, you're going through one of the big tanks, the real huge tanks of oxygen about every hour and a half, 2 hours. So that's just from a perspective of things I don't have to worry about that, our other people are really busting their butts on the procurement of supplies and so forth. It's something to think about.
Awesome. Scott, I know you don't have a lot of time. I'm going to tell us about your experience. Try that again.
Yep. All right. Hey, welcome. Hello. Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure to be amongst this brilliant set of folks here. Hey, Laura. I don't get to see you enough. Okay, let's get right into it. I figured what I could best offer is to tell you about two patients that I saw on my last shift at my imaginary hospital, not my real one, of course, because I can't talk about that. So at the Janus General, the first patient was in room 3, and this patient was sitting at 58%. But he seemed to not realize that because he was perfectly happy and smiling and interactive and talking to us, and initially got put on a nasal cannula by EMS, which was how he brought to us at 58%, and then a non-rebreather mask. And we wound up putting him on oxygen-powered CPAP. And his SATs came up to high 80s and then would dip back down to, 78. And then we'd ask him to roll over from, sitting bolt upright to his left side. And then, he had a pretty sizable belly, but we convinced him and he rolled onto his belly and he came up from 76% back to 92%. And we just kept him that way until he got admission to the high acuity floor and stayed on that since I've been checking on him. So that was bed 3. Bed 4 was same basic saturation, came in satting around 60%, but he did not look good. And in terms of gestalt, what that difference was just what any experienced ED or ICU doc would just tell you is the, LLS score. He looked like shit. He just did not look like he was handling it, but he was still talking to us. He was still interactive. But we had our doubts about whether we were going to get him through without intubating. And he was a little bit sweaty and he didn't look great. And his initial labs came back and his D-dimer was, I think, 3,500 and his CRP was up. And this patient was clearly in a inflammatory state. He was not a happy hypoxemic. He was an unhappy hypoxemic. And we tried him on high flow. We didn't bother going to CPAP because it was pretty obvious to us that at some point in the next few hours, if we didn't intubate now, he was going to have a precipitous intubation, not because of his hypoxemia, but because of everything else that was going on. And these two presentations, which I could burn into the minds of everyone who has not yet had their COVID surge start yet, because you need to recognize these two different patient types because they are different. And we were treating every single patient initially, just as Marco and Cam both mentioned, we were treating them initially as if they were both the second patient type in which their hypoxemia was the indication for intubation. But that first patient I mentioned is a very, very different looking patient. And if you choose to intubate your first 30 or 40 before you learn this archetype, then you are wasting a good number of your ventilators. So you must learn from our experience, the happy hypoxemic is not the inflammatory fulminant COVID patient.
Do you think those fall into that same L and H category that-
No, I think that's a different categorization. I think all of the inflammatory patients probably, my guess is progress to H, but you could easily make an L who's non-inflammatory in H if you flood them with fluid and do poor vent management. And I'm with Cam on this one. I hate anytime I have to go beyond 40% on FiO2. I'd happily put them on APRV before I'd have to raise up my FiO2s in a lot of patients. There's some you have no choice. But the point is, that's not these patients. These patients, I think, are high FiO2 up front. And then see if you need some recruitment from CPAP after you get their FiO2s up.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Scott. Thanks a lot. All you guys, great, great info. Rory, you've been hit pretty good too these days.
Hey, yeah, can you hear me?
Yep, gotcha.
I'm Rory. We're down at Washington, D.C., and we're basically, our ED is full of COVID patients, our ICUs, all of them now, all our MICUs and SICUs are essentially full of COVID patients. So we are in it. I think everyone so far has said the highlights. We also made the same mistake as everyone is intubating early. Essentially, after 6 liters, they got intubated, and we filled up a lot of ICU beds with patients on the ventilator that may or may not have needed it. For me, you know, this disease has really forced you to change like almost everything you know about medicine and critical care. You know, you're forced to question like what is an actual saturation that sustains life in an otherwise well-looking patient, and then you're forced to ask like, how fast can someone breathe before they tire out when the disease they have is not associated with a low lung compliance like you normally see in patients who have respiratory failure and don't have COVID. And then you're forced to ask, how do I get someone's oxygen up when they have no recruitable lung and their lung compliance is normal? And so it really, over the past few weeks, has asked us to change a lot of what we do in the practice with very little evidence, which makes us all very comfortable about it.
Yeah. Laura.
Let me get you. Yes.
Yes, I got you on. Yes. What's your perspective so far on this point of intubation? How do you think we should go ahead?
Well, you know, as putting on my anesthesia hat, I too drank the Kool-Aid of anything more than 6 liters or an FiO2 over 0.5. We should be looking at intubating these patients. But I'm so happy to see that pendulum swinging back a bit into, you know, what else can we do for the normal lung compliance patient? Those two different phenotypes that were just discussed is fascinating. And so I agree with everything that's been said. It's just something that we haven't seen yet. I'm in Ottawa. I do anesthesia at the Civic Hospital. And so we haven't hit our big wave yet. We've just seen people sort of coming in odds and sods thus far. And so, you know, how we've been dealing with them is actually, first of all, thinking about our PPE. And I don't think that we can have a ventilation discussion with these patients, about these patients, without first talking about adequate personal protective equipment. And I think that that's been a huge thing here. And I don't know about you guys, but I kind of feel like this is the first time in my career where I have to actually think, aside from the odd TB patient or the patient with rabies, which does happen sometimes, you know, what's my health going to be like after I deal with this patient? So PPE, I think, is the most important thing. And so I really love the idea of high flow oxygen, just as long as you can keep your oxygen stores going. And if you're relying on those big H tanks, or even wall oxygen, that's become an issue in Italy. So I think once you reach the stage of intubation, I think quite honestly, it's pretty straightforward. Don't do dumb shit that you don't normally do. Don't do it in a box. Don't do it, you know, with people that you've, you know, not had a briefing outside the door with before. Do it with profound muscle relaxation. Do it with full PPE for aerosolization and airborne precautions. And these patients are, I don't think, going to be any different than the general population. Anatomically, they're not going to be difficult. I don't think we're going to be cutting the necks of a lot of these patients in CICO. But we know out of the Italian literature, almost 6% arrest post-intubation. So we need to have an advanced care plan for every single patient that we intubate. And we need to sort out what we're going to do should they arrest once we start positive pressure ventilation. So that's kind of my take on everything thus far. And I'm just going to put a plug in. We're coming out with PPE paper, encouraging a third tier for intubation and high-risk procedures this week. So I will tweet that out once it comes out.
Thanks, Laura. I mean, I think everyone's probably seen that hospital, I think in the southern Italy, actually, Marco, you probably know, that has managed with these, you know, really strict measures to have no infections, or at least no further infections to staff since they started. And I think whenever these PPE discussions come up, to me, you know, the full bunny suit, you know, with the full face mask, the PAPR air purifier, that's the standard. Anything below that is a compromise in risk management and et cetera, which we may not have a choice because of, you know, one, ability to decontaminate those suits, the availability of things. But I think fundamentally, that's it. The max PPE would be the standard. Scott. Wait.
Yeah, I can't agree more. I think PAPR it should be the standard for any hospital that could get their hands on them. I will put out one thing out there. The disposables are tough to keep in stock. And so people were using, for better or for worse. I've discovered a plastic bag with that Papper hose underneath makes for perfect utility. You lose almost nothing.
Wow.
And so having the machine, which is infinitely reusable, you know, those filters actually last for weeks. That will get you through if you run out of disposables. So there's no testing on that. It's not approved, but it will work.
Awesome. I want to give Josh and Adam a chance to chime in here. Unmute yourselves and hop in.
Oh, okay. I'm unmuted. I just want to throw in something real quick here. And this is probably something we'll discuss a bit more in a couple of weeks, but I get the sense that folks think that once we intubate these patients, it's a death sentence. I don't think that's necessarily true. So far, we've gotten about 6 of our 8 patients off ventilators, oftentimes within a period of about 5 or 6 days. And I think that, you know, some combination of steroids, heparinization, APRV may eventually work for these folks. I'd be interested. I think, Adam, you've extubated a bunch of these folks. You're ahead of, a couple weeks ahead of us.
I think we're lucky. I want to say most of the people on this panel, because of the brutality you guys have endured for us, in the West Coast, we've been really lucky because we got the warnings from Europe, from China, and from the East Coast. So our curves, our population interventions are really helping. Our curve's pretty flat, and we have low volumes per day. So if it's like this on the coast, I think that's the big caveat and why it creates some awkward perspectives for us too, because we're not inundated. Everyone wants to intubate at 6 liters for infectious prevention, cohorting, those kind of things. So that's currently where we're at right now. But to your extubation point, again, because we're cohorting in units, we have a lot of RTs and nurses and a low ratio, we can mobilize patients. They're not overly sedated, and it helps a lot. I want to get back to point A, Laura. That's my favorite quote of this whole webinar: "Is don't do dumb shit." I think that I think that's huge. I think right now, the COVIDocracy, the COVID idiots, whatever that new term is so frustrating with people doing shit they would never have done before this disease showed up. And they're forgetting how to be the awesome clinicians they were before this. And I'm seeing lots of harm, including intubating people that shouldn't and getting problems with the intubation or doing things while they're ventilated that you would never do in these patients. So I think it's the fear of the unknown and the anxiety. So sticking to normal physiologic processes that we know help and don't harm is the way to go. So to answer your point, Josh, I think the big thing is prevent early self-induced lung injury and people cranking in the hyperinflammatory patients, and then just help the lungs out. Don't crank them with tons of PEEP that they don't need and worsen the dead space, blah, 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 blah.
Rory, let me get you unmuted. Yes.
Can I just ask a question to the group? Because as far as when to intubate, I think the two patients that Scott outlined are, as you become comfortable with these patients, are fairly easy to differentiate. But, you know, these patients will test whatever threshold you set. And so a lot of times the happy hypoxic or the silent hypoxic, you know, will continue to look well and their sat will continue to drop and you will arbitrarily set a sat that you're going to intubate them and they will pass right by that and still look quite well. And so does anyone have any thought or what, how low do you go before you actually just intubate them just for purely hypoxemia?
So I'll tell you, this is Cameron, you know, today we had that precise patient and it really pushed our limits and the patient was saturating in the high 30s. And I'm not lying. And he felt very well. And he was on his phone. And his respiratory rate was around 20. And his blood gas showed a PaO2 around 30. And his lactate was 1.2. And it really, this was one of the many we struggled on. We had other people, he didn't look like shit. And we had many others that did. We ended up intubating the others. And so, you know, this is, I think the struggle with this disease is that for me, even the looks like shit score throws me off. These patients seem to go through these you know, malarial like fever spikes, and they look terrible, and they can go from looking good to terrible to good pretty quickly. And it really is, it's just a, you know, it's a very all my innate instincts are just thrown off. And really, I find myself really gathering with other attending and just discussing, because something about this disease is just something I don't think we've ever seen. You know, as far as the type L and type H, and this is one thing I'd ask to the group, I have never seen someone present as type H. All right. I've never seen these patients don't present hypotensive. You would think that if there was a massive inflammatory response leading to hypotension, someone would present late. I mean, these people, no one is coming to our ER that doesn't have COVID. Like, it is well known in New York that you stay home unless you really have to come in. So, you know, I'm very perplexed about this disease. So, you know, to go back to your question, we're really struggling with that, and we're moving our sort of targets up and down. And that's one of the problems. You set a target and then you want to change it, and your target becomes loose, and it really messes with your mind on shift. But, you know, one thing I'd also ask the group is, you know, and Gattinoni raises this, do you guys believe that this is gut instinct, and there's no way we can know that the transition from L to H is a natural evolution of the disease, or it may be due, whether, you know, in many cases we have to achieve a viable PaO2, but is due to our, you know, high pressure ventilation, which there's no way around it unless we find some other way to achieve a higher PaO2 for a progressively hypoxemic condition.
So quick question. So what did you do with this guy, Cameron?
So I left and he was not intubated.
Are you still in that, or did you?
He came up, you know, so now we're at the point where really we are, you know, we don't want to do anything that has negative effects, but we're prepared to pretty much do anything that is not harmful that may be beneficial. So, you know, we have only two nitric oxide machines in the whole hospital. So we actually used inhaled nitroglycerin just to test it out. It's a cheap thing, and we didn't think it would be harmful. We gave him dexamethasone. And he's sitting in our resuscitation area being closely monitored and getting serial blood gases. And, you know, we're going to look at the lactate and we're going to try to figure out what the best thing to do, but it's extremely hard to intubate a man who he told us, you know, we're sitting there thinking about intubating him, and he wants to let us know that he knows people with PPEs, and he wants to know if he can give them to the hospital, you know? So it's truly baffling. It's a baffling disease, you know, and I just, you know, I'm waiting for us to figure out what the true model, what this disease really is, you know. Is it more like, you know, pediatric respiratory distress syndrome and a problem more of surfactant? Is it actually, you know, is the mechanism of disease similar to high altitude sickness? You know, what is this disease? Because all I know is I've never seen it before.
Any thoughts, guys?
Yeah, I got to agree with Cam on this one. I think most of the progression from L to H is probably iatrogenic. And he's absolutely right. Sometimes we have no choice. But I wonder if in many cases people are forgetting about the permissive hypoxemia that they were doing up until the point they finally put the tube in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you were tolerating 82 and the patient looks great, and then he dropped to 75 and that happened to be your number and you intubated him, and then you don't want him to be 95%, that's going to be a pretty rough road to get to. And the steps it's going to take to get there are going to be anathema, I think, to those lungs. And what's worse is the FiO2 drops off in a lot of these cases too. Like, people are willing to tolerate a high flow at 150, but then when they put them on the vent, they can't fathom 100% FiO2 at a PEEP of 5. And I think the shifting of that leads to a lot of problems. And then I don't even know exactly what to recommend for fluids at this point, except to keep them dry, but not too dry. But if you're not, if you're a profligate fluid giver, or the patient drops their blood pressure from the excess PEEP you gave and you give them a bunch of fluid, I think that combo might be where our H comes from.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. um, So one thing that I've seen sort of pop up and a number of people just comment was the presence of these very sticky secretions, and maybe combined with the fact that due to precautions, is it possible that bronchoscopy has been a bit underused and that, you know, this may be an issue in the whole shunting? Any thoughts on that? Or people who've had a lot of patients, have you had secretions issues? Have you been doing any bronchs? Have you had a lot of plugging?
I certainly haven't. I haven't found secretions as a big issue from our patients, either the intubated or the non-intubated ones. And I don't know, maybe there's a problem there. Maybe because, you know, Gattinoni's theory that they've lost hypoxemic vasoconstriction. And so you are putting blood flow to the areas where you have excess secretions. And so it's the less ventilated areas, it becomes a problem. I'm not sure. It's rather diffuse. I'm not sure bronching them is going to make much of a difference.
Cam, anything on that?
You know, I haven't, truthfully, I haven't kind of noticed the secretions, and bronchoscopy is one of the many things that, unfortunately, the, you know, the fear of the virus makes it so we can't necessarily do all the things we would normally do to patients. So, you know, bronchoscopy is sort of been clearly out of our arsenal. So I haven't even really considered it. I have found that some patients do likely aspirate somewhere during this event. And we have had what looks like some aspiration pneumonias in patients that sort of kind of day 3, 4, 5 start building up a white count and do then appear to kind of have one of your more typical low compliance pneumonia fever type conditions in the ICU.
Laura, I think you're going to say something.
I just wanted to ask Marco what his experience has been with bronchoscopy of these patients, if he's needed to do that due to thick secretions.
No, actually, we didn't perform bronchoscopy. Most of all, because all the atelectasia we've seen were very small ones. We never had a patient with a major atelectasia in the emergency. I don't know about ICU, but in DD, no. So we never had a real issue about it. Sometimes been proposed as for in doubtful diagnostic. We have a patient with clear clinical disease, but repeated negative swabs to perform a lavage. So we had just a couple, but just for diagnostic reason, whether to put them on tocilizumab or not. That was the main reason to perform it. But we have a small number of pneumologists. Two of them are struck with the disease, so we are in dire straits for bronchoscopy.
Thank you. Wow.
Okay, well, I hope we find out more about this. So if we get back to some of the nuts and bolts things, so once you guys have taken the decision to intubate, and just in rewind, it seems that no one has a really hard specific SAT to a SAT line. As you were saying, Cam, that line can change. It'll be really interesting to see what everyone's experience shows on that. Once you've got them intubated, I think everyone's leaning more towards not using a very high PEEP, given that you've got, or at least in those patients who have a fairly high compliance. Do you have any particular settings that you guys like to go with right off the bat, Rory?
So I think the most important thing to do is uncouple your PEEP from your FiO2 and your oxygen saturation. The problem is a lot of people are still calling this ARDS despite having a high compliance, and some will even say high compliance ARDS, which to me makes no sense. But the idea is, the danger with that is you start using FiO2 PEEP tables or some other way to kind of titrate, try to get your oxygen saturation up using PEEP. And I think that can be pretty dangerous logistically in a hospital. A lot of times, you know, you've got these patients, people don't like to walk in the room too much, and there's this kind of reflex of RT or someone else just to turn up PEEP in the hopes of getting the FiO2 up. So uncoupling that from the very start is important. You notice when you intubate these patients, their sats drop immediately to very, very low, disturbingly low during intubation. And then if you do nothing, they just come back up. It just takes a few hours for them to come back up, but they come back up. So at first we would add PEEP and we would say, oh, they're recruitable and they come back up. And I'm not sure we were recruiting anything because they had normal compliance. We may have been, you know, redistributing blood flow at the cost of lungs, but it may have just simply been the lungs, the sat was going to come up anyway. We just kind of assumed that it was our PEEP that was doing it. So we've worked pretty hard at uncoupling those. The way we titrate our PEEP now, is use a driving pressure to kind of find the ideal PEEP. I think you also have to change your driving pressure threshold. You know, the typical driving pressure of 14 that we've done is people with ARDS. These patients have much lower driving pressures. 14 for me is an alarm that we're already over distending them. I find most patients at most need 8 or 10 of PEEP. And so that's kind of the simple approach that we've had. I've been playing with CPAP in them and getting them to breathe on their own. That's a whole lot harder. They do have quite a respiratory drive. I think part of this is they don't have the encephalopathy that a lot of the patients we typically intubate do. And so it's their brain is intact and they're pretty hard to sedate and reduce that respiratory drive. Since we stopped intubating the ones that have just hypoxemia and are breathing normal, most of the ones we now intubating are already very tachypneic and have a work of breathing. And so they require really, really high levels of fentanyl to get them to breathe kind of normally and comfortably. And it also seems that it's a very sensitive trigger. Like you'll have them at 200 and they're breathing at 40, and then at 225 they're apneic, and you're kind of like titrating to find that zone, and that becomes somewhat logistically complicated because you're just trying to reduce how many times you enter the room. So it's troublesome, and I haven't been as successful with CPAP as I'd like to be on these patients. But I think the big thing, the take-home message from me is just decoupling your FiO2 and your PEEP.
Yeah, great. And I think for those who are not familiar with what Rory's talking about is essentially the mode of ventilation that he's been playing with, and then some of us have tried here and there, of just using plain CPAP, no pressure support, no nothing, just titrating the CPAP to get the patients on a relatively useful part of their respiratory function curve, and letting them go from there.
Yeah. So as a background, that's my primary mode of ventilation on most of my patients in the ICU, and I do it rather successfully. I've had a lot of trouble doing it with these patients. Their drive to breathe by the time you intubate them is really high, and you need massive amounts of fentanyl to reduce that.
And we may be running out of that fentanyl too.
Yeah, can I ask guys about that? Everyone in the panel, the experience with the dosing regime. I know Josh posted something today, but I'm finding that too. And I don't know if it's a mix between their profound hypoxemic respiratory drive or not. I know that there's some interesting stuff coming out of the UK with maybe the virus attacking the respiratory center. Who knows? Lots of theories. But profound, like 110 mics of propofol, massive amounts of hydromorphone because we don't have tons of fentanyl right now, ketamine, Presidex, clonidine, full concoctions. What's everybody's vibe? Because sometimes you're trying to slow them down when they're on CPAP. I totally agree. I like it. But when their rest rate is 45, you just get tons of calls from the RTs and everyone trying to give them loxapine when they don't really need to.
Yeah. I've had a couple patients that were intubated in other hospitals and then transferred to us. And I think they were intubated with that philosophy of intubate early. And interestingly enough, those two had, I'd say, regular types of sedation requirements. And then we had a couple that we intubated a little bit on the on this sort of, let's try not to intubate. And one of them, like, I think I had him on everything, including paralytics, you know, ketamine, fentanyl, propofol, paralytics, then started some benzos. And it was hard to get him to breathe under 25 or 30 and get in sync and just sort of relax.
Yeah, I find ketamine and dex that I love for my normal CPAP patients to encourage them to breathe does nothing for these patients. You need an opiate. You need something that truly suppresses the respiratory drive. And even with massive doses of those, it's pretty hard to get them to breathe at a level that you're comfortable.
Yeah, we're in New York. We're going pretty hard on the opiates. And in general, you know, whereas in the ICU, we typically really want people to stay awake. We want them to breathe. You know, we want their diaphragms to work and everything like that. In this case, I mean, our numbers are just so high that what I am saying is that after the patient, gets RSI'd, the goal would be that for them never to remember anything really until you are kind of ready to bring them out. And if that's 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, and partly that's because we just have a tremendous amount of patients. And I do think that desynchrony is not good in these patients. And unless someone's closely monitoring the desynchrony, which as you said, requires sort of chasing, it's just difficult. And I find it much safer. I even tell the nurses that do not worry, you cannot over sedate these patients. The average vet run is, you know, 4 to 12 days. So even if we shut off all the drips in 3 days and it takes them 2 days to wake up, I think it's much safer to avoid any desynchrony. I think that in general, the event management, what will be the hardest, and this is within the confines of all the institutions I think we work, you know, especially with very, you know, conscientious respiratory therapists, is you as an institution, you have to figure out what SAT goal you're going to be okay with, because that really will determine everything. You know, if, you know, I don't like to go over peeps of 8 to 10. So I typically will intubate them. And I believe that their vitals, this is what my sort of instructions are, their vitals before you intubate them should be the same as after you intubate them. I mean, that's what I've kind of seen. And I think if you get hypotensive, you got to try to back off the peep. Now, if you're satting already at, you know, 79 and you're hypotensive and you're on a peep of 10, you know, you got to figure out what you think is more injurious, you know. You know, having them in a SAT of 75, or pushing the peep up to, you know, 12, 13. And I think that's the difficult decision, but I see this as sort of an oxygen first, leave your FiO2 at 100% and try to use as little peep as possible. And when you run into that, kind of crossroads, which you will often between a SAT you're typically not comfortable with and a peep, you know, around, you know, 8 or 10, you just have to try to decide in a kind of unknown arena that we're in, which you think is worse. But, you know, otherwise we keep them pretty sedated. You know, I like to have them breathing less than 20. We are sort of every day running out of different meds, you know, so we run out of this and our you know, our administrators work hard and procure this. And so, you know, we run out of, you know, rocuronium, and then we use this, and then we run out of all sorts of things. So every day we have to check with pharmacy to see what we have. And we've been pretty good at restocking, but that's how, you know, the approach we've taken is generally when you intubate them, be gentle, as low peep as possible, high FiO2, and try to keep their vitals like they were.
Cameron, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So my concern, and we've both trained under Nader, so I know you probably had this concern at some point, that if we just empirically set our peep so low without actually checking a compliance, we will start to have silent de-recruitment over the period that they're intubated, and you're going to lose lung volumes over the course of their ICU. And obviously at some point you can transition from your L type to your H type simply by just de-recruitment and fluid and so on and so forth. And so my only concern with just empirically leaving their peep as low as possible rather than actually titrating it from a driving pressure compliance is that eventually you might just start to de-recruit lung. And since you've already lost, or we think you've lost hypoxic vasoconstriction, that actually might make things worse as you create more shunt physiology.
No, I agree. You know, and I don't really know a physiologic way to explain this, but this to me does not seem to be a problem. You know, at least in the high compliance, low elastin stage of de-recruitment or recruitment, which is to say, you know, my goal is to keep them in that stage, and when they move over into the high compliance stage, in my mind, to have as little a lung injury as possible, which I do think is likely unavoidably from our vents. And so what I mean by, you know, not de-recruitment is, you know, we are proning people, and I don't think what we are achieving when their SATs, when their PF ratios go from 100 to 300 is really recruiting lung. I could be wrong, but it does seem to all be some kind of change in vascular flow. Such that I guess I am less worried about de-recruitment than increased pressures you know, causing injury, which is so strange because this is absolutely the opposite that I was thinking going into this, you know, but that's why I would not use APRV, which I, you know, having trained under Habashi, you really start to love it, you know, but why I just would not do it in a patient that was just put on the ventilator.
I have often found I never see the point because I'm not re-recruiting lung and they're typically breathing enough to breathe on their own. And so my APRV just becomes a struggle with either they're completely apneic and so I'm using my release volumes to breathe for them, or I have them on CPAP but they're breathing too fast and I'm trying to titrate my fentanyl. So that's been kind of my problem with APRV.
And I guess for Marco, I have a question because, you know, in this model, you know, I go to high flow quicker than I go to CPAP you know, because I also think it seems like coming out of Italy, and I'm really sort of, I look at you guys to, you know, I really am trying to follow what Gattinoni's doing because I think it's what we have from a very, you know, experienced and obviously very intelligent and accomplished person. But do you find that even with CPAP and that patients seem to be converting to a low compliance, you know, high elastance state?
Sorry, Cam, I lost a bit of your question because the connection's a bit wobbly.
Oh, that's okay. So, you know, one thing we've been debating is should we, you know, let's say someone fails high flow, should we then try them on CPAP? And I guess I also have concern, kind of reading the stuff from Italy, that CPAP in some ways is no different than the ventilator in that you are providing, you know, if you put someone on a CPAP of 10, you are providing positive pressure, which again may be completely unavoidable. And it's not to say that we, you know, there's any other thing to do. You know, I would urge some place to put someone on VV ECMO before they get intubated, but do you... from your experience and from other Italians' experiences, it seemed like there is some lung injury or transition to, you know, to basically type H with non-invasive CPAP.
Well, bear in mind that in Italy, we haven't that much high flow. So we don't have high flow machines at my hospital. Whereas we do a lot of CPAP, especially with the helmet. So the helmet's much more feasible when you have a large number of patients. And this this cultural habit of ours of using helmets has been much emphasized now that we have a patients overflowing. So it's much quicker to use, much easier. Despite the fact that obviously on a helmet, you don't get all the information you get back from a ventilator or from a CPAP machine. That said, yeah, we do have a certain number of patients that do transition from let's say the L type to the H type. But my feeling, we don't have numbers, I guess nobody has even good numbers now. My feeling is that there's a lot of noise now. We have to filter all the information we get. So I state it clearly, it's just my feeling, my experience on my patients, which is really a limited number. And that's a selection bias, okay? These patients do not transition very much. That I would say that they're a minority. Our average patient stays on CPAP, doesn't get worse very much, has very long stay on a CPAP machine, just like it has on a mechanical ventilator.
Can I, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, as long as you're not titrating your CPAP up to really high levels, I would treat CPAP almost like high flow. Most of your, if you take out high flow and non-invasive CPAP, all your other oxygen therapies that are non-invasive, you just have trouble keeping up with the flow rates of the patient, right? And so they start to entrain room air. And so you never really get 100% FiO2 until you shift to high flow nasal cannula or CPAP. And I imagine what CPAP's doing, as long as you're not over-distending them, is just you're matching the patient's flow rate so you truly can get 100% FiO2, similar to what you can do on a high flow nasal cannula.
Laura?
I just want to ask a question to the panel. Rory, I loved how you said we need to uncouple PEEP from FiO2 in these patients. That makes a lot of sense to me. Just like when we intubate these patients, we say it's an RSI technique that has classically been associated with a full stomach with cricoid pressure. And I don't believe there's any role for cricoid pressure in these patients except under very specific circumstances. So we need to uncouple dense neuromuscular blockade and induction drugs from the use of cricoid pressure when we say no bagging technique. I'm wondering if we need to uncouple a high respiratory rate in terms of banging away at these patients to decrease their respiratory rate on a ventilator. Do we really need to do that, or should we just meet their inspiratory flow requirements and just ride it out with a respiratory rate of 40? I know, again, it's a very challenging thing to not have them into our very predictable algorithm that we use.
I mean, from my perspective, it's how they're breathing on the ventilator. You know, doing it primarily when I work outside of COVID, it's APRV and CPAP, and you're always looking at their work of breathing and the negative force they're generating. And if you're seeing them take these massive flow swings on the ventilator and using a lot of accessory muscles, you're assuming essentially that their transpulmonary pressures are high and they're doing lung damage. Whereas if they're breathing comfortably and you look at their flow curves and they're nice and low and flat, you're kind of assuming that no matter what that tidal volume is, they probably have the lung to be able to do it. From my experience,
Sort of really bring it down for those of us that aren't intensivists, your goal is not necessarily to decrease respiratory rate, but just to decrease self-induced lung injury.
Right. To make sure they're breathing with a safe volume and safe pressures.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I wasn't going to take any of the questions live, but I'm seeing a couple of things that I just want to, address quickly. And there's a lot of people asking here about the fluids, and say, for instance, I've got this one saying, if they get hypotensive with PEEP and they do not have ARDS physiology, what's the concern with fluids? Why do we need to be very conservative with fluids then? Another one saying, my question as well, if this is not ARDS, how does it change fluid management? And again, still being fluid restrictive in L types, concerned that it's contributing to preventable renal failure. So, Josh, you've been quiet for a little bit. Why don't you field some of those?
I don't know. No, seriously. I think a lot of it depends on, I think one theme that we keep on coming back to is the different phenotypes of these patients. And, there's some patients who may come in after days of having nausea and vomiting and no PO intake, and they may be truly hypovolemic. And so there may be a role for those patients. Alternatively, patients who are euvolemic and hypotensive due to, sedation or positive pressure probably will benefit less from volume. So I think ultimately you need to just evaluate the patients. I tend to lean a bit heavily on the history and kind of take it on an individualized basis.
Yeah, I mean, my two cents on this is respiratory failure patients really have to, show me they truly are hypovolemic and not just, low mean systemic venous pressure resulting in very volume responsive looking dynamics, but that they really are dry before I give them any fluids. My patients don't get any maintenance fluids. I don't know, what are your approaches, Rory, Adam, Cam?
I've kind of switched. So we're not, we're not doing anything aggressively in either direction now, So before I was kind of thinking that this was more of sort of a pulmonary hypertension, right heart failure, aggressively diuresome kind of a cycle. But I don't know now. And I do think that many of these patients tend to get at least when we, ride them out kind of on high flow, they tend to get pretty dehydrated and we try to get them to eat, but it's just sometimes hard. They feel pretty bad a lot of the time. And now when we intubate them, so long as they're not hypotensive and their vitals are the same as they were, I tend to give them, a liter over, 10 hours. So nothing quick or nothing, we're not yet putting them on maintenance. I've sort of heard from shared experience from London and these sort of emails going around that, what we once thought may have been right heart failure and high pulmonary pressures, may in some sense be hypovolemia. So for now, we're really just, we're trying not to do anything in either direction too aggressively. But whereas I was very fluid restrictive before, or kind of more advocating for that, I think now, so long as you know, they're not hypotensive and I think their PEEP's not too high, you know, I'm willing to give them a little bit.
Adam, what's your approach?
I guess it's really hard to generalize, because I think that the hardest thing for me is, like, this disease process is affecting so many different patient populations that it's really hard to say, oh yeah, everybody needs 10 cc's per kilogram, because that doesn't really work. And you kind of have to see the person in front of you. I have screwed this up. I will admit it, that I'm cranking diuresis and moving on to patients quickly. And then when their dead space starts going up and they're hypotensive and the levo's climbing, I realize I probably overdid it. And then other ones I have to go back to because the overnight staff, maybe the residents gave a bit too much fluid and caused some harm. So I'm sorry, I can't give you a magic number. I think you got to see the patient in front of you. I think what Cameron said was totally right, that some people, they're on their nasal prongs, they're hanging, you're trying to mobilize, they're self-prone and they're texting, they look great. They can keep up and other people can't. So they use some more free water through the gut, or dear God, Josh's head might blow up. They might need a little IV fluid, but ideally through the gut if it's working, for sure. But I outside of this cytokine patients, I'm not seeing a lot of hypotension per se, to be
honest. I think all of you guys are right, actually. Individualizing is the way to go. And I've seen a lot of stuff about, you know, lung point of care ultrasound in the last couple months, not so much on you know, on venous congestion / cardiac stuff. And I think Cam, to your comment, it's relatively simple, you know, if you've got a machine and you've got the time to do it, you know, you guys are being crazy slammed, but to take a look and take a look at your RV, take a look at your PAPs or RVOT Dopplers, IVC, to get a sense if you've got, or even just simply, you know, your RV to LV ratios, if you're, you know, if you have the knowledge that these patients didn't have any serious pre-existing heart disease, to get a gestalt, you know, gist of that with where you're sitting with your RV function. Anyone else doing some cardiac focus?
So I spent, like, I think it was 2 weekends ago now, going through all the COVID patients and scanning them all. And outside the few that had known heart conditions, they were all decompressed. I mean, their RVs were slamming. They had normal venous return curves. I didn't see anyone with any kinds of venous congestion. Now, we had a tendency to keep people dry, so it might be partly that. And I think what Cam said is right. They, you know, they're breathing at 30 and 40 over a course of days and not really eating and drinking, so they could be volume down. But I think it's also a component of this loss of vasoconstriction. I mean, their pulmonary vascular resistance is probably pretty low, and I was pretty shocked. I thought I was going to see a lot of right heart dysfunction, and I couldn't find one case of any kind of right heart dysfunction or any kind of venous congestion.
Which kind of goes against the pulmonary hypertension microthrombi kind of thing. I have to agree. I had maybe one, and even then the RVOT Doppler looked really smooth, a type 2 at most, nothing too, you know, nothing too suggestive of marked pulmonary hypertension. Anyone else? Josh, have you been doing some point of care ultrasound?
A lot of my patients have had pretty poor windows, so it's been pretty challenging. But I agree with you. I think it's going to be super important. I found APRV to be very helpful, and one of my major concerns about that is that, you know, am I increasing the pulmonary vascular resistance, and am I going to get into, you know, veno-sarca and systemic congestion? So that's something I'll be keeping an eye on.
Can I interrupt, Josh? Because I'd like to hear your experience with APRV, because I think the rest of us have found it fairly frustrating. And you described some good success. Do you mind just briefly talking about it?
Yeah, I've had really good results with it. You know, we're putting patients on it pretty early. My preference is to put them on it immediately. And what I found is that patients typically recruit, and their FiO2 requirements typically go down, you know, pretty substantially, to around like 50% within 6 to 12 hours. And then we chip away at the PHI and, you know, gradually wean people. I haven't had a lot of issues with CO2 clearance. And honestly, I haven't had a lot of problems ventilating these patients. I don't know if I've just gotten lucky. Maybe Vermonters are very healthy, but like, I haven't need to paralyze or prone or do any of these things. And I've gotten
Are they spontaneously breathing, or are you using your release volumes primarily?
You know, it's interesting. So there do seem to be a couple different phenotypes. So there's one phenotype where they're probably less sick and they're probably more of these like happy hypoxics who got intubated. And those patients are easier to sedate and they can breathe spontaneously and kind of synchronize well and be beautiful and awake and just awesome on the ventilator. I think there are a couple other patients who are more of like a cytokine storm phenotype who are harder to sedate and have kind of larger tidal volume requirements and more air hunger and tachypnea. And they're kind of similar to those patients that you were describing where it's really difficult to kind of get them to not take like 800 cc tidal volumes at a rate of 50.
And then, so are you paralyzed or you're just sedating the hell out of them using your release volumes to ventilate?
The latter. I really just dislike paralysis. We're putting everyone on steroids. And then I think, well, also, first of all, we're running out of sesadricurium, but I think if we put everyone on steroids and paralyze them, we're going to see a lot of myopathy.
And then, sorry, I'm hogging everything. Your PHI settings around, where are they initially?
I'll typically start at 30 and then chip away over a period of days.
Okay.
Are you finding problems with hypotension or no?
I haven't initially.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I've had the opposite. The few ones I've run on APRV, the PHI of 18 or 19 would give me massive release volumes because their compliance is so good. So I haven't really even had to use true APRV settings. And then the ones that you can get, they're essentially go to CPAP reasonably quickly. But like you said, I think at this point, these are the patients I'm no longer intubating and just riding them out on non-invasive. And so by the time the patients get sick enough to be intubated, they become that air hunger patient, which is much harder to run on CPAP or APRV.
Right. Let me just change gears a little bit here as time's moving along and weaning these patients. So from what I've been hearing, and I haven't gotten really to that stage yet in our wave, but people pass weaning parameters essentially do well, but then and sometimes fail and need to be reintubated. So what have you guys been using as a strategies for weaning and extubation or the decision to extubate?
Felipe? Yeah. Can I just cut in here before we get to weaning? Can I hear from the members of the panel about prone positioning, proning the awake patient on, you know, high flow or on CPAP, and then proning the awake patient who is intubated? Just what people's experiences have been. It just seems like it's become huge around Twitter now.
Yeah, we skipped on that point. I think a little bit. We've certainly been using proning right from the get go on the patients on just nasal cannula, the ones that are completely fine. Just tell them, okay, flip, spend so many hours on your belly, try to sleep on your belly, etc. And same for the high flow nasal cannula patients. We keep we keep flipping them, getting them to do as much moving as they can, and that's been really well. We've got a few patients we've been riding like that who, you know, were a little bit borderline. We're requiring a fair bit of high flow, and by the earlier criteria, certainly would have been intubated. But just with the high flow and or nasal cannula and lots of self-proning, I think that works very well. I think for the ventilated patients, I think it's still up in the air whether or not we really need to go on this regular kind of proning routine.
We have a branding problem. I think it's like everyone proning all paralysis, you need a team of eight. I think we need to call it adult tummy time. The pediatricians are right that like, just let them do what they do in bed and let them roll around. Like nursing colleagues love it. Cause you're just like, yeah, move around in bed. You're fine. Right. And everyone is so fixated on the safety and the protocol. I don't know about you guys, but you're on 6 liters nasal prong, move around in bed, man. If you feel comfortable on your stomach, try it. Cause as long as you don't have any other issues. So I think branding is the problem. Maybe because I'm a father of young children, adult tummy time just seems easy.
Now, I have a question. So I've encountered a bunch of patients who have morbid obesity and they can't lay on their belly. And so my question is, should we just give up on the proning, or would it be beneficial to have them lay on one side and then lay on the other side and lay on, go back and forth?
Yeah, I think proning is even a misnomer. Like the way we do it is they lay on their belly, they turn on their side, they turn on the other side, they sit straight up, and then they start that routine again. I don't think it's just proning. I think one of the problems that we have to get across is, again, like we have to get away from calling this ARDS. We have to stop thinking about proning as a way to re-recruit. We're shifting blood supply, right? And so you're just going to try to experiment which way actually shifts the blood supply the best. And Cam said this really well a couple of weeks ago. This is a disease of progressive hypoxia that at some point's going to stop. And so you're just buying time, and the proning is just a way to hopefully buy time to keep them off the vent, and hopefully that the disease process stops before you get to the vent.
Sometimes I wonder if, you know, the benefit of all this is, you know, it's probably good for every patient in the ER to prone at night. I wonder if this will break down the wall and, you know, this will just be a thing in ERs from now on, you know.
Our exclusion criteria is if the patient can't prone themselves, you shouldn't be proning them awake, right? Like they should just be able to flip over and do it themselves.
Good point.
We started ventilating patients in a sitting position. If they can afford it, we put them also sitting, because, you know, just to shift the blood flow around.
Yeah. Now
I have one question about that just for the panel. You know, have you noticed that patients, the SAT will get better, and so we feel better, but have you noticed if do patients seem to feel better when they're prone?
Some do, yeah. I would say that some do, and most likely those are the ones who will benefit most, because especially if they do self-proning, these are the ones who will continue. It's easier to have them. I talk about just non-intubated patients.
Yeah. No, what I worry sometimes is that the patients that don't feel well and then we prone that look better but still don't feel well, I get a little concerned about, because their number gets better, which makes us feel better. But, you know, I know that what's going on doesn't appear to be sustainable. But we're proning, I mean, we're advocating it, and, you know, even the nurses are pushing them to do it. And
actually, before I get to the weaning part, I want to get Marco to tell us a little bit, and Josh, because you guys, Marco in the field brought us up, and Josh really gave us a nice polish on the concept of splitting. Marco tweeted out a picture a week ago or so that was fairly controversial, at least in some circles, but was clearly out of necessity. We're hoping, or many of us are hoping, not to get there, but by the sounds of it, and maybe in New York, you're getting close. Can you tell us a bit about that, Marco?
Sorry to interrupt. I just have to run to work, so I'm gonna see you guys.
Thanks so much, Rory.
See you, Rory. Stay healthy.
Bye, Rory.
A pleasure.
Good seeing you, Rory.
You too.
Well, so the splitting thing was actually, obviously, as you said, done out of sheer necessity. We had run out of vents, we had run out of helmets. The choice was either leave a patient with a PF of 120 or 150 on nasal cannulas or share a ventilator. And so we did the splitting. And as I said many times, I have done it because we were getting into a sort of warlike scenario. And when we did it, also, we didn't really know what was going to be the curve. We had in mind that we were just about to be hit by the sort of mass casualty scenario, which actually wasn't what happened, actually, because we thought of it like a tsunami, and it wasn't. It was just a slow tide rising, constantly rising up. So at one point we ran out of vents, but it didn't happen anymore. So we just had 8 patients who were on the split vents, and they fared more or less just like the others. 3 were weaned, 1 has already been discharged, 2 have been intubated. I would say that the rates of the worsening were more or less average. I would still do it just as an emergency measure. I also devised a little gizmo to split a single limb ventilator, but I didn't publish it because I thought this is going to stir more controversy than it was going to be beneficial. So I've left it up to my nurses to just say, if you need to split a single limb vent, this is the trick to do it. I did it using a cutoff from a nasal cannula, but I discussed about it on a Slack group, and that's it. I don't want to stir any other controversy about it.
Well, you can send it to us and we'll keep it in our back pockets just in case.
Okay.
Josh, split it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really interesting question. I don't think there's a really simple answer to it. There are two issues at hand here. I think one is splitting non-invasive, which I think is what you did, right?
Yeah.
So that makes a ton of sense to me. And I think that's safe. And I think that's a great thing to do. So I don't think there's a lot of controversy there. I think there would probably be a bit more controversy about splitting invasive mechanical ventilation, because the problem then is that you basically need to do pressure controlled continuous mandatory ventilation. So you need to deeply sedate or paralyze the patient. Personally, I'd rather do that than watch someone die. I don't know.
That's the logic.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get back to that weaning decisions. I think we've probably only got Cam here and Josh to tell us about weaning of these patients and decisions and maybe Adam. So Cam.
So truthfully, I moved from the ICU to the ER, so I've been sort of following what they've been doing up there. But I haven't been heavily involved in the weaning part. I will say that a lot of the patients, from what I'm hearing when I talk to the residents up there and so forth, that it seems that it's more prolonged than one would expect, than the sort of usual stepwise kind of transfer the work onto the patients and then, hopefully take the ventilator off. And what I've heard from other units in the institution is that, yeah, people seem to get there and then you sort of drop the PEEP and they get tachypneic and they sort of just fail those trials. We have had patients extubated and successfully. What I always wonder is, I wish we could know, we just knew a number from 1 to 20 about the severity of someone's disease, and is it possible that, in some sense, those with very severe disease, no matter what we do, are the ones that are difficult to get off, which is hard to say, but I wish I could say more about, the weaning process, but I'll listen to you guys and take your advice.
To kind of speak to your concept of a number, I think one belief that I had based on, one of the earlier patients I had was, we put the patient on ventilation. They got a lot better. They're doing great, but their inflammatory markers are like sky high. And there's a tendency to wean, and we start trying to wean down and then the patient gets worse. So I do think that there are different phases of illness. I think if the patient's inflammatory markers are super high and their lungs are just on fire, you're probably not going to have a lot of success. So we've started kind of hitting these patients with steroids or higher doses of steroids or tocilizumab, various things to get the markers down. Once the markers are kind of down and the patients have improved, I've been okay kind of weaning patients in a somewhat more aggressive way than I thought would be capable. Initially, there were a number of reports similar to what you're referring to about patients kind of getting off the vent and falling apart. And that hasn't been my experience. So far, we've gotten 6 patients off the vent. And I was there for 5. I was kind of like around the ICU for 5 of them. We're typically extubating people to non-invasive CPAP, BiPAP ideally. And we haven't actually seen a lot of deterioration. I've been happy to see that. What about you, Adam? You probably extubated more than I have.
I think I think the high compliant patients are really easy to wean early, because that's not a problem. Get them onto spontaneous modes, whatever your du jour is, get them mobilizing. And like you said, wait until that inflammatory phase, if they're heading into it or coming out of it, is resolved, and then extubate them. I think the trouble we've had, a very small population, is the ones you have problems weaning in normal diseases, right? You're 80, you're comorbid, you're weak, you got steroids. Now you have critical illness, maybe neuropathy, myopathy. You had some vent dyssynchrony, you had compliance issues. So we really sedated you, you're delirious, those kind of things. But I don't think that's the vast majority of patients we're seeing. I think the troubling ones, because they have long vent courses, but those are the ones that we're experienced to anyway. So the high compliant ones, get them spontaneously breathing, watch their fluid status judiciously, don't overdo it, don't underdo it, mobilize. Yeah.
Thanks. Laura, I think you were going to ask something.
I wanted to hear the panel's thoughts on extubation of the COVID patient and if you think that they're still a high risk aerosol generating medical procedure. We're seeing patients come to the OR for sometimes completely unrelated procedures. And you know, who are COVID positive and or assumed COVID positives, you know, pending testing. And, you know, my thought is that extubation is just as high risk, if not more high risk, because I actually don't have a paralyzed patient anymore. They are spontaneously ventilating. We're asking them to do all the maneuvers that actually cause aerosol generation while we're taking out the tube. And so our approach to that is full high risk aerosol generating medical procedure, PPE. Is that being used, you know, these patients that are being extubated 10 to 14 days after they've been intubated?
Yeah, I think, you know, it is an aerosol generating procedure. So we're using full PPE, we're using negative pressure rooms. One point of kind of controversy is whether or not you can extubate patients to high flow nasal cannula or CPAP. Initially, there was some concern about that. But we are doing that. The ANZICS guidelines said it was okay to do that. And I'd like to believe, kind of being maybe an optimist, perhaps a stupid optimist, that over time the viral load may decrease a bit. So if we're extubating someone after a week of illness, they're probably not quite as like a nuclear viral thing as when they're first intubated.
But you're still using full precautions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, sure.
Yeah. I think that's a nice point, Josh, of everyone going straight to a mode of support nonetheless post extubation. Like I said, I haven't extubated any yet, but that may be a way to go, given that there's been a few reports of people deteriorating. Sort of, we're kind of used to, once someone's passing SVT, they're extubated, they look good for an hour. Fairly unusual that they require intubation 5-6 hours later or 12 hours later, but apparently this seems to have been an issue. So maybe an IV or at least high flow right off the bat is a good thing.
Yeah, because that would be the approach we would do in somebody who had kind of still inflamed lungs or just recovering, right? That versus a trauma patient or anything that didn't have lung pathology, who you would fly to no problem. But I think that's the problem, not fear, appropriate fear, but for people not doing, again, like Laura said, don't do dumb shit. You wouldn't extubate someone who still had some nasty looking lungs, but had minimal support. You wouldn't just extubate them to 2 liters. You'd probably extubate them to CPAP, especially if they're 80 and is on home CPAP anyways and has a big belly. But I think this fear of aerosolization and questions about different levels of PPE is preventing people from doing the things we should do for our patients. So learning from Marco and everybody in Italy and Europe and cohorting patients, I think, is really important. So all your staff for their shift are on the appropriate PPE, and you're doing things like extubating beside you. The guy around the corner is on high flow, the gal's on CPAP, and you can do that. But knowing that these areas are a bit of a war zone probably for viremia, and you appropriately have to have the correct PPE and precautions.
Nicely said, Adam.
I've got a little interesting and appropriate little questions here since we're talking about weaning that popped up. And anyone who's listening, please don't, I'm not playing favorites. I haven't been looking at the stream the whole time, but someone just asked Dr. Shaikh about any thoughts on the timing of tracheostomy if indicated. My thoughts here would be that since we have Cameron said this when we spoke last time, the virus seems to turn itself off and people get better quickly. So I have a feeling that we're probably going to hold off most trachs in everyone goes somewhere between a week to 2 weeks or something like that. Probably try to stretch it out to that 2 weeks. That's what we're sort of informally planning to do. I don't know if anyone else has actually done any trachs on these patients. And Josh, you barely need to ventilate them, so probably not. Cam, have you seen trachs being done?
So far, we haven't been doing trachs, but there's, you know, now we have patients that are you know, pushing that time frame, and so there are discussions, we'll see what comes of it. How about Marco? Are they doing, you know, for prolonged, vent runs, are they doing trach for sort of pulmonary rehab?
Well, right now they're doing it in my hospital, but we have a huge issue that is we have such an overflow of patients that most of our post-ICU units have been shifted into a COVID ordinary hospital wards. So we have a huge problem of where to put the patient after he's been discharged from the ICU. And this might be a limiting factor to trach. If just as with intubation, any trach that could be avoided, despite for the patient, it's also that would increase, let's say, make the whole system smoother, because it's very likely that we won't have any rehab place in the near future. So we might, delay the mortality into a very late phase because of inadequate care. So I think that's an issue. Lucky I'm not an anesthesiologist.
I'd love to reiterate that, Marco. We're having that problem too, as just there's the issue logistically. Do you have bedside perc trach or do you an open trach? What's less aerosolizing, et cetera? I think that's a different argument. But where does a COVID trach go? We don't know in our hospital. We don't have that workflow yet. And smarter people than me, unfortunately, are going to have to figure that out. But that is a thing that ideally, I think for rehab, it would be the way to go. But there's a huge issue that where do you put them?
Yeah, good question. I'm going to ask Ross to feed me a couple of the better, more pertinent questions to this that he's seen pop up so far. Otherwise, you guys have any other things that we haven't really talked about too much on a respiratory sense so far?
Can I ask the panel? Scott mentioned a PAPR using a clear plastic bag. There's a lot of things coming. I made a comment about the box, the intubation box, and I find that there's a lot of MacGyvering coming up. I think it's our fear of running out of appropriate PPE in the setting of our fear of our own health and safety. And I just want to ask the panel out of curiosity, are you doing MacGyverisms in your ICU, in your emergency room, in order to cover things that you're having supply issues with?
We've done a little bit in terms of those tricks to preserve N95s, because it's almost comical how a week previous or a few days previous, say, no, we're not keeping, throw them all away. And then there's this, this directive, now we have to save them, you put them in a bag and we'll try to, we'll find a way to clean them up. And then they end up handing nurses sometimes, well, here's your N95 for the day, you know? And so we MacGyvered those, a way to take it off, safely put it in a sort of a container with looping the loops around in order to be able to put it back again without contaminating yourself when you put it on and off, et cetera. That's about the MacGyvering that we've had so far.
For us in New York, we certainly don't have PAPRs, and we generally have one N95 a shift, but our hospital has done pretty good in trying to rustle up the N95s and gowns and so forth. But we generally, moved in the ICU. Initially, we were changing gowns between rooms. Then they were all COVID rooms. So, generally now people are, using the same gown and generally using one N95 a day if they can to get through the shift. People are sewing sort of covers for the N95s. I mean, we are getting a lot of support from the community, sewing things and food and so forth and everything. But I feel like they're doing most of the MacGyvering for us. So.
Fair.
On kind of a related note, as we run out of PPE, are different shops restricting people who can work with the COVID patients as far as age or high-risk conditions?
I know recently they pulled any pregnant women away from taking care of the COVID patients. I think we informally try to avoid having the elderly, physicians and more senior physicians be overly exposed.
Initially in my hospital, we weren't having, pregnant women. We were trying to keep them on the non-COVID side, but our hospital has just slowly become, almost a full COVID hospital. So, our telemetry areas have been turned into ICUs. The ortho teams are taking care of critically ill COVID patients with, you know, hospitalist and intensivist instruction. So, you know, everyone now is basically involved in, you know, the COVID response in one way or another, if you're working in the hospital.
So a couple of questions have come up. People have asked a little bit about ECMO, and I think many of us have either wished or hoped to have a VV ECMO in some of these patients. I think Cam mentioned having them when they're still not intubated. But ECMO, anyone? Josh?
I mean, I'm not working in an ECMO shop, and honestly, Boston and New York are getting hit pretty hard. So just, I think the logistic reality of this is that we're not going to have access to ECMO. My hope is that we can ventilate these folks well enough so that we won't need it. I think the coagulopathy will be enormously problematic. So we've had huge difficulties maintaining CRRT circuits. And I imagine if you had an ECMO circuit and it keeps on shutting down, that'd probably be a problem.
Yeah, I think that is going to be the answer. It's just the logistics of it and how many ECMO machines there are and then the problems of getting the circuits. I think it's just practically difficult.
Are you spinning anyone, Adam?
No. I guess there's a bigger point of this that it's hard. Because I think everybody in this pandemic realizes that we always have a duty of care to our patients, the individual one, try to do the best thing. But for me, the personal one, if we're talking about we don't have enough N95s, I think committing people with an unknown prognosis to a high resource intensive intervention that we don't really know if it will change their underlying outcome, I don't know if that's the right thing to do. I just don't know. I don't know if ECMO would change hyperinflammatory cytokine storm phenotype that we can't totally identify yet. So the punchline is no, we have not done an ECMO. We haven't really needed it because, to be honest, the ones that are not salvageable have a lot of comorbidities and a lot of other things going on. So.
Okay. Someone else asking about the timing of proning for intubated patients. And I think we're globally more or less moved away from this sort of automated proning that was initially. And it's more of an on-demand if we feel we need it. And again, to reiterate that, it seems like the proning isn't trying to go for recruitment as much as it is like in the ARDS, but just to buy time for the disease to pass. Anyone else have any specific thoughts on the timing of proning?
You know, I think that if you accept this is somewhat different than ARDS, you know, then I think you can move away from sort of the time, not the time constraints, but, you know, typically with ARDS, we're pushing for longer proning times, you know, 14 hours or so, or, 16 on, 8 off or something like that. I think that, you know, if you're willing to go for less, then you can avoid some of the complications of proning. And especially if the resources are getting diminished, a lot of the units are just opening in different areas of the hospital and pulling nurses that aren't necessarily having prone patients before. So a lot of MICUs where all the nurses, you know, you get 5 nurses around and they know exactly where to pad them and they know, you know, to look for edema and so forth. I would say it's probably safer, you know, to probably go on the shorter side and maybe more frequently than doing long runs. Although, you know, that does require more people more often at the bedside. We're thinking about starting to prone in the ER and possibly even having, you know, the doctors, the residents, and the attendings, and maybe the nurse do it. And I think it is feasible. And if not fully prone, then possibly putting them on their side, but just to kind of keep shifting them around. You know, I know people have sort of said like roasting a pig or something like that, but just kind of slowly turning them and hoping that, again, while you may not be recruiting, you're shifting blood flow to buy time to hopefully get them through this, you know, terrible viral disease.
All right. Well, there has been a lot of questions about therapeutics, and I think maybe we'll try to address that another time if we can manage to get everybody back on board, maybe some different people as well. I think there's a lot of fascinating questions around the anticoagulation, immunomodulation, et cetera, et cetera. And then hopefully in a week, I wouldn't be surprised if we actually know quite a bit more in a week. So I really, really wanted to thank everyone for having taken the time. You know, time is so especially precious these days, whether it's rest or work. So thanks for doing this. I hope that a lot of people, got some good information out of this, and I hope we help to shape things for the better.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for organizing this. Excellent, excellent job.
Yeah, it's great.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Thank you very much. Thank you to everyone.
Thank you, guys.
Great to see everybody smiling and healthy. Thank you, guys.
Good night, everyone.
Stay safe.